Blog Talk Radio.
He is the last of his kind. All that remains of a once powerful nation. Some think he is a myth. Some believe he is the chosen one, who will bring balance to a world at war. And some will stop at nothing to destroy him.
I'm your host, Akamani Albay. And this evening, we would be dealing with America and its laws. What are the mechanics to the Constitution of the United States? How do it benefit the people of African descent in America? What do the facts state? Now, we have thousands upon thousands of people of African descent inside the United States. And I've been running into a lot of people that say the Constitution of the United States state this, and the Constitution of the United States said that, and on and on and on. All over the United States and them parts of the world. I'm here to tell you that this is what I get. But before we go into the broadcast, first of all, for those of you who are new, I want to offer you free articles this evening. This is what we do. We give you our free articles, the 14th Amendment Exposed, as well as the Commerce Game, Secrets of America, straight out of the mouth of a judge. I don't know what prompted him to tell this kind of truth, but nevertheless, just send me your, just send a blank email to tahaka53@hotmail.com. And the 14th Amendment Exposed, and I will send this to you to tahaka53@hotmail.com. Just send me your request in an email. Just say, send me those free articles you mentioned at tahaka53@hotmail.com, and I'll get that to you. For those of you who are on your social sites, if you're on Facebook or LinkedIn or MySpace, StumbleUpon, Twitter, it doesn't matter where you are, just send me your friend request, I'll grant it. That'll give you access to my wall so you can read the articles and this, that, and the other that I put there for you. Now, what we're going to do this evening, first of all, we're going to look at the state of affairs inside the United States when it comes to law in America. And then we're going to go back to look at some things that we maybe have forgotten, and then we're going to come back to make sure that we clearly, concise, got this down to a science. Okay? This is what we're going to do. Now, the phone lines are open. If you want to make a comment or you have a question, just simply dial 310-982-4184. Raise your hand and we'll answer your questions. 310-982-4184. Now, for those of you who do not know that if you are of Moorish descent inside the United States, you have your own government. Go to www.moorishamerican.gov.org. Register there. Put your name, put all your family members' names there, and examine that site very, very carefully. The shows that we do are there. Register with your own government. Now, when you listen to what we're going to present to you this evening, that will let you know what you are supposed to be doing. Hands down, bar none. There is no doubt about it. So we're going to get into this evening's broadcast, but before we do, we're going to come to you with some...
Moorish Americans, we have just added a ton of new information to Tahaka Archives. The way to access that is to go to www.tahakaarchives.org. That's TAHAKAARCHIVES. That's TahakaArchives.org. We placed a ton of new videos in there, PDF files, and Word documents. Don't hesitate. Get on over there and check it out. Okay? All right.
Another researcher wrote to me just yesterday, said, you know, if people only read the Constitution, they would be horrified and shocked if they knew it was, you know, what it was. But she says, everybody says they read the Constitution, but they don't sit down and read it and take a whole day to digest what the words mean. It's technical.
Of course. I mean, doesn't it make you, like, with your insurance policy, not want you to read it?
Yeah, exactly. Same thing as an insurance policy.
Right, and the only reason it comes into severe importance is if you get into an accident, you know?
Yeah.
Other than that, it's like, oh, please spare me this stuff.
Right. Well, that's like Chuck Baldwin, who's a preacher on the Internet.
Yeah.
All right, he wrote an article, and he was speaking for the National Committee on the Constitutional Party on October 25th. And his opening was, Christians should support the constitutional government.
Right.
Well, I wrote back to him.
Yes, you did.
Oh, yeah. You got that, right?
You want Christians to support the corporate bylaws of a private corporation?
That's right. I said, why do you want Christians to support the corporate bylaws of the private corporation, a.k.a. U.S. Constitution, is beyond belief. That document was deceived and deceived the American and so-called Christian, who is supposed to have no other gods before them. The U.S. is a god, and that god has its corporate bylaws, Constitution, to go by. I see you, too, are deceived, just as the Lord admonishes all of us that there will be false gods. A republic is a corporation, whether you know it or not, when you go back to the etymology of the word. Rome was a republic. Rome adopted the law of Hammurabi in becoming a republic. That law is the law merchant's code. It's used in every country of the world. Even the Pope uses it.
Okay.
So you want the Christians to support a law merchant con job? Not for me, and never will. I revere that piece of trash as you do. I see you fell hook, line, and sinker for that corporate document and the corporations that devised it. One day too late, you will wake up. Do you really want their law or his law? You can't be a fence sitter as you are. He never responded to me.
No, he's not. He's another one like some of those cats on news with views, whatever. You know, and they're the. I think they're not. Those like those that right there, and some shows on the networks. They continue to perpetrate this basic lie,
right,
that Christians should get involved in things governmental, and that there really is a justification to try to help out Jehovah by killing people.
Right.
But, you know, two things. One, what stuck in my ear is when you said that Hamilton cajoled Washington. I don't think he went kicking and dragging into the night for this for the bank.
Oh, no.
No. No. And here's where I'm going with that. All the people on this side of the street, all the ones who get it, know that history, texts, you know, and books that want to perpetuate a certain urban legend, it's all been spun. We know our textbooks have been spun. These people will tell you that. Well,
right.
Inside that also has always been, even in the secular world, in the world of grammar school and middle school and high school, history textbooks, that this country, you know, it's like behind the backhand, but it's like this country was God-breathed, ordained, yes, only in the sense of God allowed it.
Right.
But there is nothing exceptional about this fictitious thing called the United States.
Right.
But we think that, so that, therefore, that enabled us to go off for the 20th century and, I mean, fight more than any other nation ever has, and still we hold the lead, we would call the league lead, in wars and combat.
Uh-huh.
But, I mean, it's because, well, God is on our side, and it
right.
is a fallacy.
Oh, yeah, because you take any other country, and they say the same thing. God is on their side, they're doing right and everything. You know, that's why the Pope created that strife back in 1213, when he used those parts of the Bible. For the words, you know. I mean, it's for their own benefit. It's like a lot of people might preach, and you can read the Bible, and you can have five people read it and get five different interpretations. You know,
well,
I mean, it's what's in the person's mind and their beliefs that they were taught when they were brought up. Now, like Montgomery said, their core beliefs would be shattered, and they can't realize that their core beliefs are so ingrained in them that they cannot accept the truth when it's put before them.
Well, of late, and I've said this on a couple other shows, I won't belabor it anymore, ad nauseum, but to say to you, what struck me as being really, I mean, dumbfounded, was when people I've, you know, exchanged correspondences with and such over the years, and even some of the show hosts, you know, who have spoken a certain way,
uh-huh.
all of a sudden, this Ron Paul thing comes up, and everything that they have been believing in, understanding correctly about the ruse of government and what it really is, and it's of Satan, because obviously he was given the kingdoms. What does that mean to you, folks? And when Christ says, this is not my world, are you making anything of this, folks? Okay. Ron Paul comes out, and I cannot believe the number of people who went from, yeah, yeah, this is it, this is our chance, to, well, you know, maybe he is, and it's like, no, it's not maybe, it's not he is. It's like, forget it.
Right.
You know, and then Jones gets behind it, who's supposed to be a Christian, and it's like, I'm looking at this Pied Piper, this Maharaj, you know, whatever, what Svengali type of situation, and I'm not believing my eyes or my ears. But when I saw that, I said to myself, "Who's kidding who here, man? I mean, if you so easily can be taken because somebody has promoted himself as your leader, say Jones, I'm saying this, all right? And you're following what he's doing because it's Jones, or have you just chucked your, or maybe both? You've just chucked your common sense." And everything that you've known. And speaking about common sense, let me ask you about this, Iman. This whole bit about the founding fathers, and they make them as like deific as possible, you know? But I mean, what I was reading is like when they all assembled, the elites down in Philadelphia, right?
Right.
The people in the States, when they saw that the Articles of Confederation were gonna get hurled and they were gonna get a constitution, that told them immediately we're just gonna slide back into monarchical rule.
Oh, yeah, because a lot of people, if you get Storing's book on, Herbert Storing, the Anti-Federalist.
Okay.
He has all the papers in there from the Pennsylvanian and the Farmer and all these other books that were written by the people of that particular state. And they all knew what was going down, and the Farmer that was in Pennsylvania, writer, knew after the fact that they were supposed to attend the Philadelphia Convention. They never went. And they mentioned about the corporation and that it was a corporate structure because the Confederation was doing pretty good, and that's why it was doing so good that they had to break it. And Washington and all those other signers, the 55 of them, were going to lose a lot of money if they didn't kowtow to the king and create this corporate structure called the Constitution, which was actually offshoot or the United States then would become a child of the parent corporation, which was England, which was, you know, controlled by the Vatican and controlled. And he said the king had told them, look, you got land over here, you got a great holdings over here, which they did. And in fact, Benjamin Franklin had 43 different names, and some of them were women's names, and this coincides with that article that I sent you on the name change, that you could change it at will.
Wait, I mean, Franklin himself took on 43 appellations?
Yeah, 43 different names he had, and he boasted about it, and he boasted that he liked to expatriate and go back to the mother country from time to time. It's in his own words, in his own writing.
Oh, he was another fool. Yeah, I know.
You know,
yeah.
And so that corporation, like if you read the Virginia debates in 1788 of Patrick Henry, he knew exactly what was going down.
Right, and I asked you a long time ago, why in the world did he cave? And what did you tell me? Because he at heart is a lawyer.
Yeah. Yep.
Mm-hmm.
Yep, he was a lawyer. He was from the Middle Temple. Because everything west of Europe was all the lawyers came from the Middle Temple. The Inner Temples came and stayed within Europe and parts of India and like that.
Mm-hmm. Which is obviously the empire.
Yeah, that's
okay, Moses. We're back now. Before we begin, this is going to be a very, very important broadcast, and what we should do is actually I think we should take notes. I didn't put that in the advertisement for the broadcast, but I think you should really get this down to a science, because if you understand this, if you understand what we are going to present to you this evening, you would know what you're faced with. If a man knows what he's faced with, then he knows what his options is and what he got to do. Now, we have had the Grand National Chairman on this broadcast for the past three broadcasts in a row. We had part one, part two, and we had part three. He told you if you can't be respected, you cannot be looked at, you cannot be regarded as a man or a woman without your own government. So what I would encourage you to do is go to www.morrisamericangov.org. Register there, put all your family member name there, and register with your government. Now you have your own government. So the man gets out of the way and say, well, excuse me, partner, you might have thought I was Negro, color of black, but here my credentials, this is what I have to say, this is what I know, and this is what you can investigate, because if there's no evidence, then you have no case. So, go there, do that, regardless of whatever else you're doing, go there and do that. MorrisAmericanGov.org. Now, for the power base, www.TahakaArchives.org, so you get it in your brain. If you get it in there, then you have power. Knowledge is power. It's all been laid out for you. We put new stuff in there for you every week. I just got in there this morning. I think I put maybe about 15
different new pieces of information in video format. So you don't have to do no reading and writing. You just, all you got to do is just sit still, absorb. Mm-hmm. Sometimes I think maybe I shouldn't make it easy. Maybe I should make it hard. But I'm not going to do that right now until I decide whether or not I should do that. Okay. But tonight, we are bringing out some very important information for you to understand. Now, we're going to go to another plug. Later on, we're going to open up the lines, and if you got any questions or comments, raise your hand. It'll give on the phone. It will give me an indication that you have something to say, and I will open up the lines and hear what you have to say. I think that's fair. I really do. So, the information that we're presenting here this evening is vital for you to understand. If you understand this, that is the starting point for you to begin to do what you have to do inside the United States. Okay,
given what most Americans believe, the next statement may be more shocking than any previous. The fact is, the United States is not a country, but a corporation contractually created by the Constitution. Your state is a country, per the law, and your original citizenship is of that country. Our founders instituted themselves to be first and foremost citizens of their respective states. As of 1787, those states already had formed a union, and they created the Constitution for the purpose of perfecting that union in forming a national government. They did not intend that the new nation have any jurisdiction or powers over the states or their citizens that were not specifically enumerated in the Constitution. They stated this point quite clearly in Article 1, Section 8, Clause 17 of the Constitution. They granted the United States exclusive legislation in all cases whatsoever over such district not exceeding 10 miles square as may become the seat of the government of the United States, our District of Columbia, and to exercise authority over all places purchased by the consent of the states. And that is all. The framers further secured the rights of the people with the 9th and 10th Amendments in the Bill of Rights. In the 9th, they established that the enumeration in the Constitution of certain rights shall not be construed to deny or disparage others retained by the people. And in the 10th, they made clear that the powers not delegated to the United States by the Constitution, nor prohibited by it to the states, are reserved to the states respectively, or to the people. The only way the federal government can have any jurisdiction beyond these constitutional clauses is by written permission or contract. Which leads us to another piece of the puzzle, the 14th Amendment to the Constitution, ratified in 1868 following the Civil War. As barbaric as it may sound today, the black slaves, prior to the conclusion of the Civil War, were legally considered to be property, with none of the rights or privileges of free-born people, only duties. The money interests took advantage of America's desire to free the slaves and found a way to use the swiftly adopted post-war constitutional amendments to enslave all of the people. The deceit is in the wording of both the 13th and 14th Amendments. You will note that the 13th Amendment provides that neither slavery nor involuntary servitude shall exist within the United States. But why the emphasis on involuntary servitude? Isn't it the same thing as slavery? Sure it is. But they had to mention the concept of involuntary servitude because they wished to retain another type of slavery, voluntary servitude. Voluntary servitude is an ancient and established concept. It was the way serfs became subjects to their lords during feudal times in England and other European countries. It was a way for free men to earn a living at a time when all property was held by a select few, and thus anyone who wanted to farm and support their family had first to agree to be subject to a lord of the land. Our forefathers hated this concept and designed our Constitution to exclude titles of nobility, making all Americans sovereign. The 14th Amendment turned the intention of the founders on its ear by making voluntary servitude a requirement for former slaves to gain the rights already guaranteed to free-born United States citizens. When the slaves were released from their involuntary servitude following the war, their status was changed from that of being property to that of being a person. But being a person still entitled them to none of the rights associated with citizenship. So the 14th Amendment ostensibly was written to provide the former slaves with the same constitutional rights of freeborn American citizens, but only if they agreed first to become subject to the jurisdiction of the corporate United States, making oneself paramountly, that is, first subject to the jurisdiction of the laws of the United States, however, limits access to parts of the Bill of Rights, as we'll explain in a moment. But first remember, anyone who voluntarily subjects himself to the laws or jurisdiction of another is, in every way, obligated to abide by the terms of any contracts or laws established by whomever establishes the rules of the contract. In simple terms, this meant that the former slaves became subjects first to the United States, and secondly to the state in which they lived. They had no sovereignty whatsoever. This status had never existed in the United States prior to that time. The 14th Amendment created a new class of citizenship in the United States, a second-class citizenship. Up until 1868, every American was a paramount citizen of their state, and by virtue of that, also a citizen of the United States, with full individual sovereignty as guaranteed by Amendments 9 and 10 in the Bill of Rights. But so-called naturalized citizens, or 14th Amendment citizens, are paramountly subject to all laws of the United States, and, having no status as freeborn citizens, have no access at all to the unenumerated rights retained for the people by Articles 9 and 10 of the Bill of Rights. That's because, in order to get any rights at all, they had to subject themselves to the jurisdiction of the corporate United States, which left them no unenumerated rights. The only rights they had were those specifically written into the Constitution. The sad tragedy of America today is that all U.S. citizens, regardless of race, are now 14th Amendment slaves due to contracts with the government of the United States through Social Security, birth certificates, driving licenses, citizenship statements, tax forms, and many other documents. The true paramount citizenship that all Americans deserve is that of their respective state, which is a sovereign citizenship. Such status would exempt them from federal and state income taxes, as well as property and inheritance taxes. This sovereign citizenship was the status held by our forefathers. Now, if you're still thinking that the U.S. government needs to have a central bank and collect income tax or it will collapse, think again. Over two-thirds of the federal government's income is derived from sources other than income tax. There is even evidence suggesting that none of your income tax is used by the government. Fees, excise taxes, tariffs, sales taxes, and other forms of income have easily supported the U.S. budget in the past and could easily support it now. We have done without a national bank for large stretches of our history, and the U.S. Treasury is perfectly capable of printing and managing a money supply. In fact, the only constitutionally sanctioned currency is backed by gold or other precious metals. This is a far more stable form of currency and is the type of money the Treasury was designed to handle. The government was doing so well collecting money under these original laws that it had amassed a huge surplus by the time this cartoon was penned 100 years later in 1887, when there still was no income tax collected at all. Up to this point, we have shown you how the money interests have, one, established the Federal Reserve System, and two, exploited a second class of citizenship created by the 14th Amendment for other purposes, and we have mentioned a few names involved in the creation of the Fed. But there are other organizations working for our economic enslavement as well, along with other extremely rich and powerful international bankers, those who support the Fed have created a global movement to centralize economic power in various puppet organizations that preach peace and stability through some variation of socialism, but act aggressively to draw nations into a web of foreign debt and servitude to their agenda. The United Nations, the World Monetary Fund, and the Council on Foreign Relations are all committed to an agenda of world domination through manipulation of economic power. The Council on Foreign Relations openly admits to being a private club, yet it is the primary recruiting post in both international banking and the federal government of the United States. Richard Nixon, Nelson Rockefeller, John Foster Dulles, Dean Rusk, Alger Hiss, Robert S. McNamara, and every president since FDR, with the exception of John Kennedy, have been members of this exclusive club where super financiers and your elected representatives can mix freely and plan the next step in the consolidation of power in a new world order.
Okay, Morris. Now, at this point, what we need to do is start looking, use common sense. What do you think that people inside the United States should be doing? What you should be doing is growing your own food, training, becoming equipped to take care of yourself, your family, regardless of what. If you heard what you just heard, then and this is just me. I had to look at it this way. If I heard that, then it behooves me to just, what can I do? What do I need to do? I need to start preparing for self-survival. That's the bottom line. If you understand this, then you can make progress inside the United States. But let's go back to the beginning. Let's go back and let's hear words of wisdom from our brothers that you may be familiar with. Let's see what they had to say about what we should be doing. Okay? So just hold on a second, and we're getting there.
I want to thank Brother Jesse Gray, for the invitation to come here this afternoon and participate in this rally, which I believe is for the good of the community, the good of the black community. And anything that's good for the black community, the white man should realize it is good for his community. Jesse Gray is one of the key persons in the Harlem area, primarily because he's dealing with one of the key problems, the problem of housing. It doesn't make any difference what else you have. If you don't have some place to rest your head, you're in bad shape. Here in Harlem, the reason we say that housing is such a key problem, when you live in a poor neighborhood, you're living in an area where you have to have poor schools. When you have poor schools, you have poor teachers. When you have poor teachers, you get a poor education. And when you get a poor education, you are destined to be a poor man and a poor woman the rest of your life. Poor education, you can only work on a poor-paying job. And that poor-paying job enables you to live again in a poor neighborhood. So it's a very vicious cycle. And usually these bad housing conditions result from the fact, as Mr. Gray has pointed out, of absentee landlords, people who are rich and live downtown and let you and I live up here in the shack. Actually, it's a form of 20th century slavery. And what you and I have to let the man know is we are peaceful people. We are loving people. We love everybody who loves us. But we don't love anybody who doesn't love us. We're nonviolent with people who are nonviolent with us. But we are not nonviolent with anyone who is violent with us. Once those intentions are made known, we can get to the nitty-gritty of the problem. We can get to the core of the problem. We can get to the root of the problem. And then we can correct the problem. There's been a lot of talk said recently because I was supposed to have said something about Negroes should buy rifles. White people have been buying rifles all their lives. No commotion. I see an editorial right here in a paper they call the Journal America. One that we happen to have a suit against for around $6 million for saying the wrong thing a few years ago. It says that we're supposed to be organizing some kind of Negroes to arm themselves with rifles and shotguns for self-defense. America is based upon the right of people to organize for self-defense. This is in the Constitution of the United States. You read it for yourself. Brother James had the Constitution. He brought the Constitution in with him. I don't know why. What is that? No, what article is that? The Second Amendment to the Constitution spells out the right of people under this particular governmental system to have arms to defend themselves. All of you know I'm not an integrationist. I'm a believer in the Honorable Elijah and follower of the Honorable Elijah Muhammad. Right. I'm still a Muslim. My religion is Islam. Right. I run into some obstacles in the Nation of Islam, and I feel that I can best serve the Honorable Elijah Muhammad's purpose and program and carry into existence what I feel, I understand, concerning his objectives better on the outside than I can on the inside. And now that I have the independence of action, it's my intention to work with everybody or against everybody, whatever the case may be, to try and get some kind of immediate solution to the problems that are confronting our people. I still believe the best thing for us to do is go back home to Africa. But while we're getting ready to go back, we've got to eat now, we've got to sleep now, we have to have some clothes now, our children have to go to school, and we need some place to work. So whatever kind of action program can be devised to get us the things that are ours by right, then I'm for that kind of action no matter what the action is. I don't think when a man is being criminally treated that some criminal has the right to tell that man what tactics to use to get the criminal off his back. When a criminal starts misusing me, I am going to use whatever is necessary to get that criminal off my back. And the injustice that has been inflicted upon Negroes in this country by Uncle Sam is criminal. Don't blame a cracker in Georgia for your injustices. The government is responsible for the injustices. The government can bring these injustices to heart.
Okay, Moses, we're back, and we have a caller with his hand raised. I'm going to open up the line at area code 773 and to hear what he has to say. Area code 773, come on in.
Blue line, the red line.
773. Okay. We don't have a caller. Now, this is very, very interesting because Malcolm, he did talk about arms and the Second Amendment and the fact that there are people inside the United States that have arms. It was never a commotion. But I've been dealing with my people for a long time, and for some reason they always tell me, Jesus said this and God gonna make a way and stuff. And I would say, okay, yeah, I agree with you, but could you please tell me what kind of weapon do you have? And, God said, but anyway, moving right along. Okay, let's take a look at
the next set of circumstances in here. If it's anybody who think that people of African descent inside the United States should not have any weapons to defend themselves, to go hunting, fishing, and trapping, to provide food and sustenance for themselves, could you please raise your hand and so you can tell us all about it? Could you please help me to understand how if somebody kills your family member, you're supposed to call on Jesus and you know, everything going to be all right and we're going to get it. Go ahead and raise your hand and we'll open up the line so you can tell us what you think. I think that's fair. But let's go back a little bit further. Let's go back.
Malcolm didn't know what he was playing with. No, he didn't. He didn't know what he was playing with. You don't jump up against a divine messenger of God like he did. He asked to die. And God obliged you. No, you don't understand. Like someone said, did you Muslims kill Malcolm? And the messenger said, and what if we did? He said, what if we did? Have you ever seen a leader scandalized like Malcolm scandalized Muhammad? Have you ever heard of anything like that? Don't you know if you scandalize a man who's loved and honored by the people, what are you asking for? You're asking for death. And he got what he asked for. And those who killed him, they weren't sneaking behind no damn counter. They came in the place where the man was preaching and killed him in front of his own followers. That's fearless men.
Okay, we've just heard the Honorable Minister Louis Farrakhan talking about the murder of Malcolm X. But let's go on. Let's get down here and let's see who owns America. Because I feel like if we can get to the bottom line of this situation, then we will know who done it. Because if you're dealing with a situation and something happens, I guess you can call me just old fashioned. I always have the same question, you know, who done it? And that way I don't waste a whole lot of time.
In 1868, the 14th Amendment was ratified, ending slavery by giving all Americans citizenship. All persons born or naturalized in the United States and subject to the jurisdiction thereof are citizens of the United States and of the states wherein they reside. United States Code, Annotated Amendment 14. However, what the public was not told, that while under the Lieber Code, a 14th Amendment citizen can only be found within the jurisdiction of the United States. That is, all government employees, all those who live in territories occupied by the federal government, such as Washington, D.C., and the former slaves. The rest of the population was not subject to the 14th Amendment, and thus could still claim jurisdiction under the original Constitution. In addition to that, after the conclusion of the Civil War, the federal government was now occupying the southern states, placing these captured citizens under the jurisdiction of the Lieber Code. The southern states had to agree to ratify this amendment in order for them to be granted their freedom from federal rule. Thus, instead of ending slavery, the 14th Amendment held all southerners captive as slaves in the plantation known as the United States of America. Just like how all citizens were turned into corporations in 1790 to subject them to the Revolutionary War debts, 14th Amendment citizens were created to be franchisees, subject to the corporation known as the United States Incorporated. And like all corporate brands, you do not have any constitutional Bill of Rights protections. Proof of such can be found in the all caps version of your name, which signifies a corporate entity. After the Civil War, the United States defaulted on its war debt. During the bankruptcy proceedings, cunning lawyers in league with international bankers found a loophole within Article 1, Section 8, Clause 17 of the United States Constitution, which allowed the creation of a duplicate entity known as the Corporation of the United States of America to replace the now bankrupt and defunct Republic of the United States of America. This occurred with the passage of the District of Columbia Organic Act of 1871, which incorporated the area of the District of Columbia into a private foreign corporation chartered in the City of London known as the United States Incorporated. This corporation designated Congress as the Board of Directors to continue the business needs of the government under martial law. Thanks to the Lieber Code, federal jurisdiction under the Organic Act was expanded to include not only all captured citizens in the southern states, but all Americans in all states. Thus, America had lost her sovereignty under the yoke of the Crown of England and the international bankers. During the same time, the Corporation of the United States adopted its own constitution, which was identical to the original national constitution. To fool the people, one word was changed from its original form, the Constitution for the United States of America, to its present-day all-capitalized form, which signifies a corporate entity, the Constitution of the United States of America. Incidentally, the Titles and Nobility Amendment was removed from this new constitution. With the Illuminati in full control over the United States, they now sought to rule the world. After the death of Adam Weishaupt in 1830, Giuseppe Mazzini was selected to head the Illuminati. In 1871, the mantle of power was passed on again to the American General Albert Pike as its new director. Pike became fascinated with the idea of a one-world government and eventually constructed the Illuminati's blueprint of world domination. His plans called for the financing of three world wars in the 20th century. The First War would bring about an atheist communist state from the ashes of Tsarist Russia. The Second War would bring about a Jewish Holocaust under a fascist government to ferment support of a Zionist state of Israel. The Third War would manipulate the differences of Christians and Muslims for their own annihilation. Then finally, political Zionism would come out as victors of all. These three world wars would require enormous funding. Since most of the royalty in Europe was already deeply in debt thanks to the numerous wars and conflicts created by the Rothschild banking dynasty, the only place left that could possibly pay for such ambitious plans was the now prosperous American Republic. After the Civil War, the United States went through a great industrial expansion. The new industries of oil, steel, textile, and railroad all needed generous financing, which the Rothschild family was more than eager to provide. To access these markets, the Rothschilds sent their agent, Jacob Schiff, to infiltrate the New York banking scene, which was controlled by J.P. Morgan. By the turn of the century, the Rothschilds had fully entrenched themselves into the tight fraternity of Wall Street banks, such as Goldman Sachs and Lehman Brothers. They now sought their most prized possession, full control over the American monetary system. With help from Jacob Schiff and J.P. Morgan, the Rothschilds formed a scheme which would seduce Congress into relinquishing control over the money supply. This occurred with the Panic of 1907, when a liquidity crisis caused many banks and businesses to fail all across the United States. The meltdown began when J.P. Morgan published rumors that the Knickerbocker Trust Company of New York was insolvent. With a bank run on hand, they were forced to call on their loans, creating a chain reaction which would threaten to implode the entire banking system. The failures continued until J.P. Morgan and Company provided a generous loan to the insolvent banks. But J.P. Morgan was not trying to save the American banking system, but rather, he used the crisis to destroy his competition by choosing which banks he would bail out. But the biggest casualty of the economic fallout was the looming bankruptcy of the Corporation of the United States, which had no means to pay back their loans, which were due in 1912. In anticipation of this bankruptcy, representatives from the world's most powerful families met in November 1910 at a secret meeting at the Jekyll Island Club Resort in Georgia to discuss the foreclosure of the Corporation of the United States and to brainstorm solutions which will prevent future liquidity crises such as occurred during the Panic of 1907. Those in attendance included Senator Nelson Aldrich, Paul Warburg, representatives from J.P. Morgan & Company, and Jacob Schiff, representing the Rothschild family. They proposed a 20-year extension on the national debt if the United States would agree to charter a privately owned central bank, which would serve as a bank of last resort by lending money to other insolvent banks in order to prevent future bank runs. A week later, they emerged with their plans to create what is known as the Federal Reserve System. Because the current President Taft would never agree to sign away the American monetary system to a cabal of international bankers, they waited until they got their man, the progressive Woodrow Wilson, into power. In return for the bankers' generous campaign contributions, Woodrow Wilson reluctantly promised the bankers he would sign the Federal Reserve Act if he was elected into office. Many powerful forces were opposed to the creation of a privately controlled central bank. To neutralize this threat, J.P. Morgan invited the major opponents of the Federal Reserve Act on board the maiden voyage of the newly built Titanic luxury steam liner built by the White Star Line, owned by J.P. Morgan. J.P. Morgan ordered the captain to steer his ship into an iceberg and under gunpoint prevented the men from escaping onto the lifeboats, killing many of his enemies in one large swoop. When word of this got back to Woodrow Wilson, he commented, "There exists this power in the world, so subtle, so organized, so watchful, that we dare not speak above a whisper when we speak in condemnation of it." At the beginning of 1913, the United States had defaulted on its debt. After being denied a new line of credit, the now President, Woodrow Wilson, faced a constitutional crisis. With no other sources of funding, he went along with the banker schemes engineered at the Jekyll Island Resort. To avoid any opposition, Senator Nelson Aldrich quickly pushed the Federal Reserve Act through both houses of Congress. On December 23, 1913, while most of Congress was away on Christmas vacation, a quorum call was issued. A few selected congressional traitors voted by voice to avoid public record and pass the Federal Reserve Act, which President Wilson signed into law. Wilson later admitted with remorse when referring to the Fed, "I have unwittingly ruined my country." This act gave away the keys of the printing presses at the U.S. Treasury to a foreign corporation chartered under the Crown of England, known as the Federal Reserve Bank.
The Federal Reserve was created by Congress in 1913, and it was entrusted with the power granted originally to the Congress by the U.S. Constitution to coin money and regulate the value thereof.
The Federal Reserve Bank advertises itself as a non-profit corporation that operates as if it's another branch of the government. However, its board members are unelected, and their meetings are conducted behind the closed doors away from public scrutiny.
The board of directors of the Federal Reserve System is chosen by the president from a list prepared by the bankers themselves.
It's important that whomever I pick is viewed as an independent person from politics.
All this secrecy becomes very suspicious, considering how the Federal Reserve monitors and controls trillions of dollars within the world's banking system. After the federal government lost its ability to issue its own money, the national debt soon soared to astronomical heights, because now the government had to pay the Federal Reserve interest on all its currency printed to circulation. But this interest on the national debt could never be repaid, as the Federal Reserve required all debts to be repaid with gold, which the government did not have. And even worse, the interest portion of the national debt was not issued into the money supply. In other words, more and more debt would have to be issued to continue servicing the growing interest payment on all loans. In order to cover this interest payment, Congress was forced to pass the income tax legislation, which became law in 1913 with the ratification of the 16th Amendment, also known as the Income Tax Amendment. Initially, they levied a 1% voluntary tax on all incomes over $3,000 and a progressive surtax on all incomes over $20,000, but this would soon increase with the outbreak of World War I and World War II. Income tax allowed the Federal Reserve System to confiscate the earnings of the common man. But the industrialists and financiers were exempted from paying any income tax because they could afford to hide their assets in tax-free foundations, which they claimed were devoted to philanthropy. Examples of such include the Rockefeller Foundation, the Mellon Foundation, and the Carnegie Endowment.
The main purpose of the income tax is not to raise revenue, but to redistribute wealth and to control society.
Technically, the 16th Amendment was not ratified by the necessary states, as it violates the constitutional clause of no direct taxes. Despite this, Congress went ahead and taxed the people anyway. The government was able to do this because under their corporate charter, Congress was operating as the board of directors, and therefore they had the authority to enter this amendment as ratified. But remember, this amendment has nothing to do with the original United States Constitution, which was replaced back in 1871 with the corporate constitution.
It's actually very simple. Congress tried to enact an income tax in 1894. The Supreme Court said that's unconstitutional. When the Supreme Court says something is unconstitutional, it's unconstitutional. They tried again in 1913, and the Supreme Court said the 16th Amendment conferred no new power of taxation. So if they didn't have it then, and they didn't get it, they don't have it. There is no constitutional basis for a tax on the wages of Americans living and working in the 50 states of the Union. Period.
In 1933, the United States once again declared bankruptcy. To make all citizens subject to repayment on the national debt, the bankers chartered a Delaware corporation known as the Bureau of Internal Revenue. But this corporation was illegally masquerading as part of the government, placing them under constant threat of lawsuit. To escape this litigation, they moved their jurisdiction outside of the United States to Puerto Rico. This occurred in 1953 when they changed their name to the Internal Revenue Service, or IRS. Incorporated as a Puerto Rican trust within the division of the Department of the Treasury of the Commonwealth of Puerto Rico. Further proof can be found within the United States Code, which lists the IRS as Trust Fund Number 62, the Puerto Rico Special Fund Internal Revenue. This was done to divert all income tax payments to the International Monetary Fund, owned by the various central banks of Europe and North America, which in turn are owned by the Crown of England.
There is a substantial conclusive body of evidence that proves that our income tax system represents the most pernicious form of tyranny. It is the greatest hoax ever perpetrated by government against the working men and women of America.
I could eliminate all income taxes tomorrow and have more than enough money to fund the government by using some other guy's bright idea. We tax the Federal Reserve at 0.0006, doubles our money until we decide to put them out of business permanently. Because we certainly should not have central banks.
The evidence proving income tax is paid to the United Kingdom is found deep within the IRS individual master file, which contains every transaction and financial record gathered by IRS officials throughout your lifetime. One of these codes determines what kind of tax you're paying. After looking this code up within the IRS 6209 manual, you find that they have incorrectly classified all Americans as domiciled corporations in either Guam, the Virgin Islands, or Puerto Rico. Furthermore, all taxpayers who filled out a 1040 form are subject to a tax for doing commerce with the United Kingdom under a treaty with the United States.
There is no law. There is no law that requires the average American worker in the private sector to pay a direct unapportioned tax on their labor and compensation for services. There is no law.
As you follow the money trail, you find that the taxes collected on the 1040 form is then sent to the Crown of England as a tribute payment. The Crown of England is a sovereign corporation located within the 677 acres of the city, found within the heart of Greater London. This tiny strip of land contains the world's most powerful banking houses, such as the Bank of England and Lloyd's of London, owned by the House of Rothschild. It is these bankers and their counterpart, the Temple Bar attorneys, that constitute the power base known simply as the Crown. Even though the Queen of England is a member of this club, she is not its corporate head. That job was given to the Pontiff of Rome. The Pope was given control over the monarchy with the signing of the Treaty of 1213 between King John and Pope Innocent III, which forever pledged England as a vassal state of the Holy Roman Empire. In 1297, that treaty was used as a precedent to incorporate the city as an independent city-state controlled by the Vatican, which would govern England without directly relying on the monarchy. Just like how the Corporation of the United States was subject to the Crown of England, so too were the subjects of the British Empire, enslaved with debt by the financial division of the Vatican, headquartered within the City of London. Today, this small clique of bankers have full authority over the affairs of Parliament, and this has been the case since 1694, when Pope Innocent XI hired William of Orange to depose the Stuart kings and charter the Bank of England. Located within the Crown of England is the original Federal Reserve Charter, which according to the Farmer Claims legal team, allocates that 67% of the income tax collected by the IRS was to be divided to the Crown of England. Another 23% was to be paid as a dividend to the 300 shareholders of the Federal Reserve Bank, and the last 10% was to be paid to the employees of the IRS to keep them quiet about this sweet deal. Since 1913, none of the income tax collected by the IRS has gone to the federal government. The federal government is funded totally through black budget sources, such as drug trafficking and off-budget accounting on the Comprehensive Annual Financial Report.
Okay, there it is. So, brothers and sisters, and anybody that's listening to this broadcast, if you are working on a job and they are taking taxes out of your check, is illegal, and you don't have to do that. Now, for those of you who do not have the most powerful archives in America, I tell you now, go to www.talkarchives.org. Let's set up the estate. Let's stop the tyranny. So you can go ahead on and put it down where you're at. We deal with solutions to the problem. Okay? www.talkarchives.org. Let's see how this thing was put together. Because before you do anything, let's get all the nuts and bolts.
Given what most Americans believe, the next statement may be more shocking than any previous. The fact is, the United States is not a country, but a corporation contractually created by the Constitution. Your state is a country, per the law, and your original citizenship is of that country. Our founders instituted themselves to be first and foremost citizens of their respective states. As of 1787, those states already had formed a union, and they created the Constitution for the purpose of perfecting that union in forming a national government. They did not intend that the new nation have any jurisdiction or powers over the states or their citizens that were not specifically enumerated in the Constitution. They stated this point quite clearly in Article 1, Section 8, Clause 17 of the Constitution. They granted the United States exclusive legislation in all cases whatsoever over such district not exceeding 10 miles square as may become the seat of the government of the United States, our District of Columbia, and to exercise authority over all places purchased by the consent of the states. And that is all. The framers further secured the rights of the people with the 9th and 10th Amendments in the Bill of Rights. In the 9th, they established that the enumeration in the Constitution of certain rights shall not be construed to deny or disparage others retained by the people. And in the 10th, they made clear that the powers not delegated to the United States by the Constitution, nor prohibited by it to the states, are reserved to the states respectively, or to the people. The only way the federal government can have any jurisdiction beyond these constitutional clauses is by written permission or contract. Which leads us to another piece of the puzzle, the 14th Amendment to the Constitution, ratified in 1868 following the Civil War. As barbaric as it may sound today, the black slaves, prior to the conclusion of the Civil War, were legally considered to be property, with none of the rights or privileges of free-born people, only duties. The money interests took advantage of America's desire to free the slaves and found a way to use the swiftly adopted post-war constitutional amendments to enslave all of the people. The deceit is in the wording of both the 13th and 14th Amendments. You will note that the 13th Amendment provides that neither slavery nor involuntary servitude shall exist within the United States. But why the emphasis on involuntary servitude? Isn't it the same thing as slavery? Sure it is. But they had to mention the concept of involuntary servitude because they wished to retain another type of slavery, voluntary servitude. Voluntary servitude is an ancient and established concept. It was the way serfs became subjects to their lords during feudal times in England and other European countries. It was a way for free men to earn a living at a time when all property was held by a select few, and thus anyone who wanted to farm and support their family had first to agree to be subject to a lord of the land. Our forefathers hated this concept and designed our Constitution to exclude titles of nobility, making all Americans sovereign. The 14th Amendment turned the intention of the founders on its ear by making voluntary servitude a requirement for former slaves to gain the rights already guaranteed to free-born United States citizens. When the slaves were released from their involuntary servitude following the war, their status was changed from that of being property to that of being a person. But being a person still entitled them to none of the rights associated with citizenship. So the 14th Amendment ostensibly was written to provide the former slaves with the same constitutional rights of freeborn American citizens, but only if they agreed first to become subject to the jurisdiction of the corporate United States, making oneself paramountly, that is, first subject to the jurisdiction of the laws of the United States, however, limits access to parts of the Bill of Rights, as we'll explain in a moment. But first remember, anyone who voluntarily subjects himself to the laws or jurisdiction of another is, in every way, obligated to abide by the terms of any contracts or laws established by whomever establishes the rules of the contract. In simple terms, this meant that the former slaves became subjects first to the United States, and secondly, to the state in which they lived. They had no sovereignty whatsoever. This status had never existed in the United States prior to that time. The 14th Amendment created a new class of citizenship in the United States, a second-class citizenship. Up until 1868, every American was a paramount citizen of their state, and by virtue of that, also a citizen of the United States, with full individual sovereignty as guaranteed by Amendments 9 and 10 in the Bill of Rights. But so-called naturalized citizens, or 14th Amendment citizens, are paramountly subject to all laws of the United States, and, having no status as freeborn citizens, have no access at all to the unenumerated rights retained for the people by Articles 9 and 10 of the Bill of Rights. That's because, in order to get any rights at all, they had to subject themselves to the jurisdiction of the corporate United States, which left them no unenumerated rights. The only rights they had were those specifically written into the Constitution. The sad tragedy of America today is that all U.S. citizens, regardless of race, are now 14th Amendment slaves due to contracts with the government of the United States through Social Security, birth certificates, driving licenses, citizenship statements, tax forms, and many other documents. The true paramount citizenship that all Americans deserve is that of their respective state, which is a sovereign citizenship. Such status would exempt them from federal and state income taxes, as well as property and inheritance taxes. This sovereign citizenship was the status held by our forefathers. Now, if you're still thinking that the U.S. government needs to have a central bank and collect income tax or it will collapse, think again. Over two-thirds of the federal government's income is derived from sources other than income tax. There is even evidence suggesting that none of your income tax is used by the government. Fees, excise taxes, tariffs, sales taxes, and other forms of income have easily supported the U.S. budget in the past and could easily support it now. we have done without a national bank for large stretches of our history, and the U.S. Treasury is perfectly capable of printing and managing a money supply. In fact, the only constitutionally sanctioned currency is backed by gold or other precious metals. This is a far more stable form of currency and is the type of money the Treasury was designed to handle. The government was doing so well collecting money under these original laws that it had amassed a huge surplus by the time this cartoon was penned 100 years later in 1887, when there still was no income tax collected at all. Up to this point, we have shown you how the money interests have, one, established the Federal Reserve System, and two, exploited a second class of citizenship created by the 14th Amendment for other purposes. And we have mentioned a few names involved in the creation of the Fed. But there are other organizations working for our economic enslavement as well, along with other extremely rich and powerful international bankers. Those who support the Fed have created a global movement to centralize economic power in various puppet organizations that preach peace and stability through some variation of socialism, but act aggressively to draw nations into a web of foreign debt and servitude to their agenda. The United Nations, the World Monetary Fund, and the Council on Foreign Relations are all committed to an agenda of world domination through manipulation of economic power. The Council on Foreign Relations openly admits to being a private club, yet it is the primary recruiting post in both international banking and the federal government of the United States. Richard Nixon, Nelson Rockefeller, John Foster Dulles, Dean Rusk, Alger Hiss, Robert S. McNamara, and every president since FDR, with the exception of John Kennedy, have been members of this exclusive club where super financiers and your elected representatives can mix freely and plan the next step in the consolidation of power in a new world order.
Okay, let's bring this straight on to the house. Let's take a look, because the man has just told us that we've been regarded as corporations, and the only thing that a corporation can do business with is another corporation. So let's conduct some experiments at this point. Any mail that comes to your house, I need you to look on at it and see how your name is spelled. If it is in all capital letters, then you are being regarded as a corporation. But now, let's, because see, all too often what we'll do is very, very quickly, we'll get junk mail. Junk mail, come on, we recognize that right away. And we'll throw it away. So, but what I want you to do is start looking at the junk mail and see how they have your name spelled, because they're not doing business with you. They're trying to get your business. But all of the bills already have your business. So what I want you to do is look at that. That will tell you who's regarding you as a corporation, who's tagging you, who's taxing you, and who's participating in the enslavement of you. And you are voluntarily going along with it. But if you see somebody that sends something to you trying to get your business, look at how they have your name spelled. Now, what we're going to do now, we're going to go in the courtroom and see what kind of power they have down there.
This is going to be the hard thing here to understand. And one of these nights, I'm going to have Destry come on the line. And he's one of the guys that I talk to from time to time. And he's going to get into the fact that if you really and truly go back and read Article 3, of the Constitution, no place, and he's absolutely right, there's no place in the Constitution that gives the judge any judicial power whatsoever because all the power goes into, if you read it, goes into the jury. And when they did the 11th Amendment, all they did was basically go back in and reword it differently and sit down saying, look, people, there's no judicial power in law and equity. But the problem we're going to run into, even though he's 100% right on what he's saying, from 1700s up to present time, we have had judges sitting on the bench.
How did that happen?
It goes back in the fact that they started out with judicial power, and it would be sort of controversial if all of a sudden that judges started disappearing off the bench.
Yeah, that would be a little suspicious.
And we never had a judge since the 1700s. Basically, the original intent, and there's controversies on this, the original intent is really before they had bailiffs and all these people in these courtrooms, the judge was basically there by himself. Because go back and look at the old movies. There was just a judge, there was just a prosecutor, and the lawyer for the other side. And maybe the sheriff was there, maybe he wasn't. The judge was basically a referee. The judge was basically there to keep decorum. If people started getting rowdy, he banged the gavel on the bench. Order, order. This is part of what is to come out of this.
Now, weren't those courts mostly common law courts?
Yes.
Controversies in which there is an injured party or injured property, person to person, people to people.
Back under the Seventh Amendment, that all cases have to be under common law. You know, $20 of value, and all had to be tried by jury. See, this is, you know, a lot of what Destry is sitting here saying he's right, and I know he's right. The point being is, it's like I was taught in school.
Right. You were taught the other way.
Yeah. It's like I was taught in school. Just because I have it in my head, and I may be, and I did math, I figured it up in my head, and I put the answer down on a sheet of paper. The teacher come up and sit down and says, okay, Rod, how did you come up with this answer? Well, I figured it out in my head. No. How do I know that you actually figured it out and didn't cheat? Put it in writing. Write it out. Show me that you know what you're talking about. And this is part of the problem that we have gotten into with so much of the movement out here, is that so much is all verbal. It's all take my word. The concept may be right. But it comes down into it's all verbal. And when you cannot walk in and show where it was done in paperwork, it's like this Supreme Court case. This Supreme Court case is going to create a problem now, because now it brings in, if we're dealing with IRS, we're dealing with mortgages, this is administrative procedures.
As opposed to what?
Opposed to common law.
And the fact that it's administrative means what, as opposed to it being a common law controversy?
Okay, because we're
dealing... Has to be an injured party.
Yeah, you're dealing with fictitious entities, and this is where we need to get in a little bit tonight. We need to discuss what is a de facto office and what is a de jure office. The people need to get an understanding of what de jure means and what de facto means. And de jure means, in our cases, a constitutional form of government. Whenever these public officials, they come to you, they just can't walk into these offices, I'm going to claim this office. They have to come to John Q. Public. They have to get your permission to hold these offices. Stop and think about it. What's all these signs out here? What's all these campaigns? Aren't they coming to you and asking you for your permission to take this office?
All right, but Rod, stop right there. There are two versions of public offices. There is an elected public office, and then isn't there an agency public office?
This goes into the private side and the public side. The public side is the de jure side. That's the public. That's the one that they come into the public and hold a public office under the Constitution as we understand it.
Okay.
The corporation is the private side. That is the de facto side.
So de facto is almost private.
Yeah, it is. It's just 100% private.
Okay, and that would mean if they were private, it would be just like a Kmart security officer trying to give you crap in a McDonald's.
That's exactly right.
Is that right?
Yes. He has no more authority outside of Walmart than a security guard, Hipkins, would have outside of the gates out on Harrison Avenue up in Ohio. Harrison Avenue is a public road. Timken is a private property.
What is Timken? Are you talking about, you mean the company itself? Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, okay, right. It's a big, large manufacturing company, right.
Yeah, it's private property, private security.
Mm-hmm.
Hey, Rod.
Yes.
This is Jeanette.
Hi.
Did you get the email that I sent you today?
I don't know. I have to look.
You would know.
I have to go back and look. What'd you send me?
Look for the letters OTC in the subject line. You're going to fall out of your chair when you read it.
Okay, I have to go back in. But
what it is, based on what your gentlemen are speaking about tonight, as du jour not being a soup and de facto is not the facts, what I sent was a document to some very high-end agencies, which opens the door into The Hague. It seems that the banks have been very busy this week, and they got into my other bank account and took $18,698.25 and then sent me a letter saying, customer closed. Now, how well do you think that went over with me?
Why, like a lead balloon?
Yes, full of razor blades. Anyway, you will see the agencies, as opposed to de facto and de jure, they got a copy of those letters. I received a phone call within half an hour of that email going out. I figured since today is Friday the 13th, I would let them sweat bullets for the weekend.
Yeah, I know. All right, let me bring Carl in because we sort of left him out in the dust here. We'll get into the discussion. Carl, go ahead.
Thank you.
I'm sorry. I got carried away.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, welcome to the Judicial Circus. I'm up in Michigan, in the great state of Michigan, right now, dissecting another case of the system taking away five farms, over $2 million. We went to court this morning. Long story short, the judge would not dismiss it after seeing about a dozen earlier cases dismissed because the motions that we put in there said, I'm going to take this one under advisement. I will send you a order. The Three Stooges was there. The trustee in a federal bankruptcy case, the trustee's attorney, and the Internal Revenue Service. And the funny part about this case, this bankruptcy case, people, is it was a con. The party that conned the people to file the petition that was not supposed to be filed to begin with, and now we have forgery on some documents. So anyway, I could spend all night with this. It's been a long day. What I was thinking about is I don't have my laptop with me, so I know we talked with another IRS case that popped up in Alaska, and hopefully, Rod, you'll share that order that came down today because that's another very, very important order that came down from the Alaska, Anchorage, Alaska federal court on this paperwork that we're filing up there in this case. We're running some test cases out here, people. And as you know, apparently we're the only ones that's getting on talk shoes or that show or this show or whatever show and talking about this stuff the way we do. We're giving you, just like the John Wright case, that appeals should have been filed. Rudy, I don't know if you're on the call or not. Do you have any updates?
It's star 8, honey, so I can find you if you are. Yes, a minute.
I had something else on my mind, Rod, but I'm so tired right now I can't think.
Okay.
But anyway, ladies and gentlemen, you know, you hear us week by week, and it's just amazing. The education and the knowledge. I'm not on here talking about me. This is not about me and my cases, because majority, you know, my cases are over. I'm here to help others. So
I'm here.
Okay. Rudy, you got any updates?
Yeah. You know, it's interesting. Hello, everybody. It's interesting that I have the opportunity to piggyback on what you've just said. I think people need to realize that at the drop of a hat, you and Rod, if finances are available, would be ready to travel anywhere to help people in their particular cases.
Okay, Mose, we're back. Now, what is happening inside the court system of the United States is the courts are maintaining the fraud. But the game is very, very simple. You have to understand that all courts around the world have to have two things. They have to have status. They have to have jurisdiction. If you just invested your time into the examination of these two things alone and went up in there with a case, they got to deal with that. When they are faced with it, they throw up all kind of junk. But you have to know and recognize the BS, excuse me, because that's all they got. He ain't got nothing else. They don't have anything else. They got to have status, and they got to have jurisdiction. Okay, let's say that you go in there and you say, well, excuse me, George, for the record, I'm challenging the status and jurisdiction of the court. I need to know if this is a federal court, a state court, so I can know which way to go. I was trained by the United States Supreme Court. Yeah, excuse me for laughing, man, because it's a game they don't. They don't have nothing unless you get to them. Oh. Okay, so they said, well, this is a federal court. Okay. If this is a federal court, is it? Because I need to know if I'm being tried. Federally, is this under a statutory jurisdiction, or is this a common law jurisdiction, amatory law, criminal law. Can you tell me? Man, hold on. Y'all just hold on a minute. Because it gets so interesting. It's so funny when you tell them this. When you let them know, wait a minute, you ain't finna just roll over and do nothing. We finna ask some questions. That's when stuff get alarming. Let's go backwards. Let's go backwards a minute. Okay.
I found something that just totally shook my world, and I want to share it with you. The 13th Amendment of the Constitution, written in 1865, says this: that neither slavery nor involuntary servitude, except as punishment for a crime, shall exist in the United States. Now, for all you guys out there that are critical thinkers, you're like me. And you're saying, hold up, I don't remember learning that. You see, because if you're thinking and listening to what I just said to you, it says no slavery, no involuntary servitude, except as punishment for crime. And then I started thinking about all the disparities in the criminal justice system for African Americans. For example, why are the prisons filled with black men? Why is the punishment for selling crack 100 times worse than for selling cocaine? Isn't crack cocaine? Why, if we know for a fact that it costs half as much to educate a child than it does to incarcerate a child, why are we then closing down schools and building prisons. These are the facts that we learn about, that we hear about all the time. And then I begin to think about, well, hold up. The 13th Amendment says that no slavery will exist except for punishment of crime. So then, by tying the two together, it made sense to me to think, I said, hold up. Maybe this warehousing, literally this warehousing of black men, is done in a purposeful manner to use them as free or cheap labor. You guys that know me know I'm not a conspiracy theorist. I ain't one of these people that goes around talking about the man and the conspiracy and the revolution and all that. That's not my style. That's not how I do. I'm just a critically thinking individual that analyzes the information as it comes. I did further research and found out that there are politicians, state representatives, that contact and have discussions with corporations, encouraging them to close their plants in third world countries, saying, hey, you don't have to do business overseas anymore. We've got cheap labor right here in my state due to our prisoners. And throughout my travels, I found out that the average person does not know what the 13th Amendment actually says. That it actually says slavery is over except as punishment for a crime. So now we have, with this understanding, a better context to place the whole criminal justice system in. And I think that if more people knew and understood what the 13th Amendment said, and then applied that knowledge to their understanding of the way our criminal justice system works and operates today, I think they will see that game is being run on us. I just got to put it like that. Game is being run on us right now for our young people. I'm not saying it's just a black thing, but unfortunately it affects us many times more. So I come to you, fellow listeners and people that are concerned about our society, with this plea. I am on a personal mission to amend or change the way people understand the 13th Amendment. Because as an educator, I understand that knowledge is power, first and foremost. And I understand when people know that games are being played with their lives and their futures, they get upset. They take action. And they also begin to make better decisions or more cautious decisions about their, you know, when it comes to their life. And I'm willing to bet that there's some young people out there that if they knew that there was a trap, a real trap, set for them so that they can be used for free or cheap labor, I believe some of them would make better decisions about their life. What do you think? Visit Amend 13, that's A-M-E-N-D, the number 13.com. You can either help us out by sending a donation, or you can join the cause and help us further spread this message by inviting us to come to your school, your workplace, your conference, any social setting or function where there's people that you feel can benefit from this information. This is Hotep, president of Hustle University, for amend13.com. Stay in peace.
Another researcher to me just yesterday said, you know, if people only read the Constitution, they would be horrified and shocked if they knew it was, you know, what it was. But she says, everybody says they read the Constitution, but they don't sit down and read it and take a whole day to digest what the words mean. It's technical.
Of course. I mean, doesn't it make you, like, with your insurance policy, not want you to read it?
Yeah.
And we're all supposed to be equal under the law. Hello? But we're not. We're not equal. You know why? Some people can run for offices that you and I cannot run for. They're called judges. And you can't run for it. And they're called district attorney. And you and I can't run for it. But once upon a time, anybody could run for judge. And in fact, lawyers were forbidden to be judges. They could not be judges. They could not be elected judges. They wouldn't even let them into the courtroom. bailiffs would keep the lawyers out. And they snuck in because they wrote people's wills on their last testaments, and then they had controversy, and so the lawyer had to come into the courtroom to testify as to the will of somebody that died, and some descendant is saying, I got cheated. And so that's how they wiggled their way back into the courtroom. And now they've created bar associations over the last 75 years and said only lawyers can be judges. This is nonsense. I tracked down the man that got the documents and printed the last copy of the original 13th. His name is Alfred Adask. And I had to go to the hill country of Tennessee. And believe me, it was hot, dry, and I don't want to ever go back there again. Out in the middle of central Texas somewhere, someplace off from San Antonio. Here's my interview with Alfred Adask, and it's riveting. Listen to this guy. Central Texas somewhere. I'm not sure where we are.
We're in the hill country.
They call it the hill country in Texas. With Alfred Adask, got hold and actually published, he says, more than 300, maybe up to possibly 1,000 or more of these books on the missing 13th Amendment. Alfred, tell me why Larry Dodge and the retired police officer Tom Dunn came to you with this information. Why did they bring it to you, and what did you do with it?
Tom Dunn and Larry Dodge were sitting around in a library in Belfast, Maine. Oh, back probably 1989, in that vicinity, approximately that time frame, 90, thereabouts. And they asked the librarian to bring them the oldest copy. They were arguing something about the Constitution. And they asked the librarian to bring them the oldest copy of the Constitution she had in that library, and that library went back at least into the 1800s, and I think it may have actually existed in the 1700s, if I remember correctly. She brought them the oldest copy of the Constitution they had, and they thumbed it open, and it had a 13th Amendment on it that they'd never seen before. And it involved titles of nobility. It prohibited titles of nobility, and it prohibited honors. And titles of nobility are to this day prohibited in the Constitution of the United States. They prohibit them for both the states and for the federal government. But this one not only prohibited the titles of nobility, it prohibited honors. And it provided a penalty. If you received a title of nobility, if you received an honor, you would forfeit your citizenship. That doesn't mean you'd be extradited and sent to another country. It just means that you could not hold public office. You could not vote. You were out of the political process if you took a title of nobility. The amendment was proposed about 1810. They started researching. They said, where did this come from? They never heard of it before. They started research, and it turns out this missing 13th Amendment was proposed about 1810, and they needed 9 states to ratify, and 8 states ratified into 1812, and the War of 1812 broke out. Everybody forgot about the amendment during the war, and in the aftermath of the war, they didn't think about it until about 1819, and I think it was President Monroe at the time. The president said, what are we going to do about this amendment? Are we going to pass this thing or not? Because they'd had 8 states voted for it, and 4 states, 5, they needed 9, and they had, I think they needed 9, but they had 4 or 5 states hadn't yet ratified or commented on it. So they contacted all these states and said, are you going to ratify or not? The problem shows up in Virginia. Virginia apparently ratified. And it is believed that they sent notice of their ratification by publishing a new edition of their state constitution, which included a copy of the United States Constitution as an appendix at the back. And this new copy of the federal constitution, included the missing 13th Amendment. The law that ordered them to produce and publish this new edition of the state Constitution with the federal Constitution, it specifically said they had to send a copy to the President of the United States, the Secretary of State, and to Thomas Jefferson. I think there were 4 people altogether. Right? But it is believed by Dodge and Dunn that it was by this means that they served notice on the federal government that they had, in fact, ratified this amendment. It's virtually inconceivable that they would have ordered the production of a brand new state constitution with a brand new copy of the federal constitution with an amendment that they didn't believe belonged to. And Virginia, of course, was the political powerhouse of the country at that time. Something like four of our first five presidents came from Virginia. It's inconceivable that Virginia would make a mistake about whether an amendment was or was not on the federal Constitution. The problem is that when Dodge and Dunn went into the Virginian archives, they can't find any records from the legislature from that time period. They just seemed to be missing. It may be they can be found today, but they couldn't be found back in the early 1990s. The result was there's not absolute proof that Virginia ratified this amendment. So there's a debate. Was it ratified by nine states or was it not ratified by nine states? There's a debate. But what Dodge did, David Dodge, he took his van and he started traveling around the country. And he went from archive to archive around the United States looking for evidence of this missing 13th Amendment. And it turns out that he found it in, I don't know, 8, 10, a dozen different archives. I don't know how many archives he researched, but he found 23 or 26, I don't recall the number now, this information. You're asking me about things that were fresh in my mind 15, 20 years ago, and they're not quite so fresh today. But he found 23 or 26 states and territories that had published this amendment as ratified in documents that they'd published over a period from 1819 up until 1870-something. Over a period of more than 50 years, this amendment had been published off and on, not always at the same time, but 26 states and territories. If it wasn't ratified, it is almost inconceivable that these states could have published this amendment by accident. I mean, the first time one of the states published it by accident, the president or somebody said, "Hey, all you hicks out there in TV land, wake up! The amendment wasn't ratified. The word should go out. You can't propagate an error like this, or you shouldn't be able to, for 50 years. Nevertheless, it was published for over 50 years, and the result is a mystery. Dodge accumulated this information. He brought it to me, in part because I was publishing a magazine called The Anti-Shyster. We were critical of attorneys. It was Dodge and Dunn thought that this amendment, because it prohibited titles of nobility, it would prohibit attorneys who use the title Esquire after their name, which is a title of nobility, it would prohibit them from holding public office or even voting. And they were all eager to get at the attorneys. And I'm publishing a magazine called Anti-Shyster, and they said, "He's the guy. We got to get to him." They thought I had 100,000 subscribers. At the time, I was publishing maybe 10,000 copies of the magazine a month. They had misunderstood how many people were reading my magazine, but they brought it anyway. And I wrote three articles on it over a period of several months. And eventually, I assembled those three articles into a book. And it included, 60 pages, I don't recall clearly, maybe 80 pages of copies of the different documents where David Dodge had found evidence that the 13th Amendment was believed to be ratified again by 23 or 26 states and territories. And when you looked at it and comes, you said, look, something has happened here. Something extraordinary has happened here. Because if this was simply a mistake that propagated for at least half a century in this country, imagine you have you got 26 states and territories are publishing books that say, this is an amendment to the Constitution and it's not so. This is a pretty big mistake. This isn't a casual thing. This isn't a footnote. This is very important information. It's inconceivable that it could have propagated for over 50 years by mistake. I won't say it's absolutely inconceivable, but it's pretty close. The reason the amendment disappeared is that it is arguably the most important amendment that was ever placed on the Constitution.
Now, Because
it not only prohibited titles of nobility, and that's what everybody gets excited about, we're going to keep the lawyers out of the White House and out of the legislature. More importantly, it prohibited honors. And the definition of honors at that time was any advantage or privilege that one group or one individual enjoys as compared to another. Now, the reason, in other words, we can't pass a law that says Al has to pay you know, an extra $1,000 a year in taxes, so Bill gets an extra $1,000. Bill would have an honor if he had an advantage or privilege. It would have meant no special interest legislation. It would have meant no entitlements. It would have meant the only thing the federal government could do is pass laws that applied to everyone equally across the whole country. They couldn't grant immunities for government employees. They couldn't grant immunities for congressmen and senators. They couldn't have entitlements for minorities or women or men or anybody else you care to name. The law would have to be the same for every man, woman, and child across the entire country. No titles of nobility, no honors, no special interest legislation. That would have meant Congress would not have to meet, in my opinion, more than maybe 6 weeks a year. They could chase their pages and their secretaries for 3 weeks, and they could spend 3 weeks debating, what, maybe a dozen laws a year that would apply to everyone equally? No special interest legislation would have meant no big government. It would have meant your taxes would be a fraction of what they are right now. If the government can't use their special interest legislation to divide and conquer and take something from this group and give it to that group, the government really doesn't have much to do. So it's part of the reason why I say this is so important. Over time, a few years after Dodge went through the, when he did the original research, and then we wrote up these articles and published the book and got the information out. A bunch of people jumped on this. A bunch of people. I mean, it was David Dodge and Tom Dunn eventually just kind of bowed out, and they turned the movement over to some other people, primarily out of Arizona. And again, I can't remember his name. I should be able to, but I haven't talked to him in most of 15 years, probably 10 years at least. Don't recall his name. Did some spectacular work. They tried to compel the government to admit that this was a valid amendment to the Constitution. Government stonewalled at every instance. They said there's no proof, there's no evidence. David Dodge went back to the same archives that he'd first visited back around 1989, 1990, where he'd first collected his information. He went back about 94, thereabouts. Went to the same archives, and every place he looked where he had previously found the evidence had been removed. Someone had studied the articles. Someone had studied what David Dodge had reported. Someone in government was paying attention, and they went to each of these archives, and they removed the evidence. And the misfortune on all of this is that Dodge, when he collected these samples, these copies from all, I must have had a stack this thick of documents, photocopies, just a page or two from these documents, where they had said, yep, 13th Amendment is real. None of them were certified. You look at them and you can see their books. All right, it's not just something they weren't digital. This was before the internet. They were photocopies. They're books. You see the shadows on the books. You see the old type fonts. There's no question. And a big variety. This isn't fraud. This isn't some. This was not contrived. This was real. But the evidence has been removed, and I don't doubt the reason it's been removed is that, again, this was certainly one of, if not the most important amendment that ever appeared on the Constitution. No special interest legislation. I mean, this was their attempt to declare absolute equality across the board for everyone in the country. Huh? There would have been no advantages. It didn't matter. Were you a Wall Street financier? No big deal. You would have no more rights than somebody who's running a little farm in Iowa.
Okay, Moses, we back. Now, let's just think for a minute. Now, it's funny to me because I deal with them on a regular basis, and they're some of the most is the most interesting set of circumstances that I ever seen. When you deal with people who are assuming that you're going along with being a corporation, and they don't know what to do when you respond to them, letting them know that you're not. They don't have no backup system. They come out. I've had letters to me, and I've had people who got letters from mortgage companies and banks that didn't make no kind of sense. The employees in there that sent it out with Well, what be happening is the manager, he'll get your stuff. When he gets your stuff, he be like, oh, my goodness. He go run down there to the secretary and get her, I need you to deal with this and you earn your keep. Show your professionalism. But she don't know what to do. And they said, and I remember one time, a lady, they said, she was doing a loan modification. And doing a loan modification, you don't pay anybody, pay the mortgage until they're done, and they'll tell you how much you're supposed to be paid. That's less than what you're paying. But they took this lady here and said, well, your loan modification has failed, and you are now officially in default of losing your home. So what we did was we went to work. We got up and talked as our cabs, and we went to sending stuff the other way. They sent a letter back to say, well, if you would give us some time to try to look at what you sent us, we will respond to this. 2, 3, 4 months went by. And I said, have you got anything? But no, they still trying to figure out what to do with what you said. So finally, they sent a letter back. They say, this matter is beyond us. We're going to have to do more research on it. But in the meantime, we have found a way that you can get a modification. y'all got to excuse me. All you have to do is when they send that junk, get that junk and respond back to it. For those of you who have archives, if you end up, give me a call. I'll tell you exactly what to send them. Credit card company, loan people, student loans, it don't matter what it is. They all be doing the same thing. Let's just go for a ride. Just contact me, Erico 904-303-9061. Access the archive, www.talkarchive.org. When you get in there, it start going the other way, it'll be the funniest thing you ever seen, because they tickle me. So they tickle me. I've had law firms. They sent back some stuff, but I have had to send a letter with one word sentence in there. What is this? And they sent a letter back. Well, we're trying to, our department of heads, we are professionals. we will be responding to you in the next few days, blase, blase. Y'all hold on a minute. Area code 720. 720.
Hello.
Hey, honey. What's going on? Come on.
Hi. How you doing?
I'm fine. What's on your mind?
Okay, so this is a wonderful topic, and this is great for beginners and whoever has went into your archives, got in there, and looked around. Let's say for foreclosure, when it comes to them getting in the archives and looking there, where should they start if they are about to be foreclosed on, or if they found out they were foreclosed on wrongfully, where should they start to correct the situation?
All right. There's a link right in there called Stop Foreclosure Now. You click on there, you go, as soon as you get in there, there's a book in there that tells you everything from every conceivable angle. You can even click on to find out if you are a judicial state or non-judicial state, which means determine whether or not you got to go to court and all that. But you actually, everything that has to deal with foreclosure from every conceivable angle is in there, under that link alone. There are several other links. It's like this, Ray. Let me explain this to you. First of all, number one, we are dealing with criminals. when you begin to understand the law, this is what I'm putting this stuff out for. If you go back and listen to the broadcast, they already told you that they are regarding you as a corporate. The whole thing, though, everything, the mortgage, the driver license, the light bill, the gas company, all of them doing the same thing. They're dealing with a fiction. Okay. Which appears in all capital letters, and then so when they start dealing with that, then okay, you know that ain't you because you already know that your third grade grammar teacher has taught you the difference between a proper noun and an improper noun. A proper noun is always spelled in upper and lowercase letters. An improper noun is all capital letters. That denotes a corporation, fiction, chattel, property, anything other than a man or a woman. There are so many different ways that you can go at them. It is unreal. But to answer your question, right there, you just click on that link right there and go in there. Stop foreclosure now. There are 25 ways to stop foreclosure right now, and not to mention all the way down there deal with the same thing. The bottom line is these are criminals. So all you it's funny to me because it's easy for me because I understand the rules of the game. You cannot play a game unless you understand the rules of the game. But now, when you understand the rules of the game, you'll be laughing too because they be coming with all kind of stuff. See, when they send you something in the mail. Threatening about, we got to foreclose. What that's designed to do is for you to be upset and panic and start running the river and running. But we don't want to do that. When we get that, we be like, yay! Like we get pulled over by police, cut the lights on in the back. I be like, yay, I got another one. And by the time I get through with it, they be like, he don't play right. Don't stop him no more. He don't. they be like, there you go again. Turn off the light. Because once they get a good dose of you with the truth and knowing the truth, they be like, maybe if we be quiet, she'll go away.
And not wake anybody else up.
Right. Mm-hmm. Because now, say for instance, all right, we say we got a bill collector. They calling you. Are you always this? You got a yada, yada, yada. They keep calling. Come with you. The average person would think, well, I'm tired of people calling me. I'm not going to ask for them. No, don't do that. Don't get mad. Get even. Because we have a Fair Debt Communication Practices Act. What you do is you simply just type up a letter. Don't do no affidavit. Just type up a letter and say, please do not contact this number anymore, and then put the number down there and mail it to them. Okay, now make a copy of it, and then you mail it to them and put a date on there and all that. Now, after they get that, and they're going to keep doing the same thing, but every time they call you after that date, let's say you mail it on the 28th, and you estimated a region by the 30th. Okay, so you start counting after the 30th, and every phone call that they call you on after that, you make a notation of it. And just keep letting them call, because when they're calling now, you can just hit a button and say, change, because
mm-hmm.
And then you drew up an affidavit, and you send it to them, and you call the phone company to say, well, I need a printout of all the calls made from this day up and that, and then you highlight them, you send it to them. You say, look, I need $4,000 for every one of these violations. Otherwise, we're going to court. I guarantee you, they ain't going in there for the violation of the Fair Debt Communication Practices Act. They'll send you a check because if they go in there and you put that telephone printout down up in the record, they through. Not only are they gonna lose, they're gonna have to pay the court calls. If you put in their punitive damages for $30,000, they gotta pay that. All this right here. So what they're gonna do is they're gonna call you and they say, well, look, this we ain't calling about that no more. We didn't need to know how much you. Would you really? You got us for $20,000. We got $10,000 right now. Would you be willing to accept this right here and let this hill go? And you say, well, I'll think about it. I'll call you later. And then let a few minutes go, call them on back and say, we're going to send me $10,000. But if y'all call me another time at the right here, I'm going to clean your clock and see a check for $10,000. Because it's all the game. And you just have no the rules of the game. Same thing go for the mortgage company. Same thing go for the police stops. Same thing go for the student loans. All the way across the board. And you know why? Because you are dealing with criminals.
Well, I do have a question on the mortgage situation.
Let me have it.
Okay, so, all right. I was foreclosed on my house, let's see, in maybe 2010, 2011, and just learning what was going on, I did send in the letters for, you know, debt validation. They sent in a copy of the contract, but the thing is that I realized is, okay, they didn't send them the original contract. I don't know how to enforce them sending in the original contract. I really don't know how to go forward with that, and it's been 2 years, and I still don't understand how do I enforce them taking it off my credit, validating that this mortgage is mine. I don't know where to start when it comes to that. I have a good concept, but I still don't understand what am I doing, what do I need to do to go forward here.
Okay, well, first of all, they never foreclosed on you. They foreclose on the fiction that you agreed to be through acquiescence because you never claim the name as your property. You also remain as a resident and all these things. So what you're going to have to do is, even though they have foreclosed on you, there's still things that you can do to there's a possibility they have not even sold your home. Do you know if they have sold it?
I've looked into the home. They have resold it to another lady. And actually, the mortgage company that had it, the company that I bought the home from, it seems like that they're still the original owner, that they didn't sell it to the second party. So I see that this second party doesn't necessarily own the property, but they foreclosed on what you're saying, the entity that I claim to be, and they have it under another lady's name.
Okay, the reason why you're seeing that is because the property is still in the original owner's name. The bank cannot own nothing. The bank can't give you no loan, nothing. You went for the whole process hook, line, and sinker. So what you have to do is you're going to have to deal with the mortgage company. You got to deal with the bank too, and you can sue them. Well, Japanese guy, they did it the same way. But what he did was he sent an affidavit to the bank. The bank said, "Oh, we made a mistake. What we're going to do is we're going to give you the house. You don't have to pay nothing. This is $400,000 home." He said, "You don't have to pay nothing. It's just yours, free and clear. But the Japanese say, no, I don't want it. I'm suing you. And he sued them for $30 million, got $40 million out of it, coke calls and everything, and the house free and clear to do what he want to do. So when you look at, even though, see, because if somebody feel like you've been foreclosed on, you most people think, well, that's it. I'm done. No, it ain't. No, you ain't. Because you're dealing with criminals. The whole operation is a criminal. All you got to do is go down, to the court of records and look and see who owned the house. You will discover it, when it comes to you, that you never did. It was already in somebody else's name. So, number one, how can they foreclose on you? If you ask them to send you the original deed and they never did, because they can't, because what they do is they collecting these properties and sell them in bundles, and the first thing to be destroyed is the original deed of the property. When you put them in that boat, they got to, by law, provide the original deed. If they say you owe them for a mortgage, produce the note. If they file foreclosure and haven't done that, they through. But now you say that you have already been foreclosed on. Now, there's things inside the archive that clearly show you what to do if you've been foreclosed on, because the people in the house, they're in the same boat you in. They don't know that.
Mm-hmm.
There are
okay,
things that you can do.
Stop the foreclosure now? That's under stop foreclosure now?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, not only there's tons of information. There's so many things that you can do with them to, you know, they'd be like, my mortgage coming, like, man, look, baby, I tell you what, just give some money when you can. If you just give some, whatever you decide to. Because you can own your house free and clear with your deed in your hand. Eliminate your mortgage. Eliminate your property. All that can be done because it is just a game. You just have
so
to know
that,
how to feel.
Well, okay, so I've studied about quiet title, quick claim or something like that, claim the deed. Is that along the lines of what you're referring to so that I can...
Well,
when I look there,
we got people that's doing that. But my recommendation to you is to take a look at this file, because it is an entire book that was bought and paid for and put in there for people who have problems with their mortgage, and it covers everything. It even covers if your house has been sold, what to do. And
okay.
You had access to archives to get in there. Since I got a ton of my switchboard is lit up, so go to www. Okay, sister.
Thank you.
You're welcome. Area code 716.
Peace, Brother Parker.
Hey, what's going on?
This is Aaron from New York.
Hey,
Aaron. How you doing?
I'm just fine. What's on your mind?
I'm back in Cali now, but I just wanted to make a comment to the sister that just called in regarding the foreclosure.
Well, before you make a comment, my question to you is, do you have the deeds to your house in your hand?
Yes.
Okay. Now you can talk.
Okay.
Go ahead, sister.
Well, I wasn't going to elaborate on too much right now, but I'm still just trying to digest my situation. But I wanted to share with the audience tonight on the number that I was going to get to you to give over there pertaining to people that have been foreclosed on, to see if they can get some money that's coming to them if they had a foreclosure between 2009 and 10.
Okay, let them have it.
Okay, audience, you need to get a pen and paper because I'm going to give you a website address and a phone number to call, because if you have been foreclosed on, there is a number, I don't know if you've heard of the Independent Foreclosure Review, that went on. They sent out forms, and there's money for people that sent in the Independent Foreclosure Review form, and there's money due to people that did not send in the Independent Foreclosure Review. So get your pen and pencil ready, because I'm going to give you this number and a website address. Some people might have been foreclosed on and might have had to move, and before they send out the information, they probably did not get it because the forwarding address of information might have been not eligible, valid at the time. But I went through the process. I got my mortgage discharged. Plus, I got some money because they was trying to foreclose on me. So, if you're ready, I'll give you the number.
We're ready.
888-952-9105. That's 888-952-9105. Or you can visit www.independentforeclosurereview.com. Also, www.federalreserve.gov. You could ask them if your name is on their list. They will ask you your name and a couple of other questions. They will tell you if your check has been mailed out, if a check was mailed out to you and you did not receive the postcard letting you know that you did have somebody coming, they will do take your name and number and address so the information could be forwarded to your new address. Okay, so they're giving out from $300,000 to $125,000, depending on what your situation was. So when you go on that website address that I just gave you, it will tell you the different categories. So if you know what category you fall under,
give me the web address again and say it real slow.
www.federalreserve.
FederalReserve. Okay.
E.gov.
Say it again.
It's like Federal Reserve.
I got it.
.gov.
.gov. Okay.
Yes. And the other one was Independent.
www.independent.
Yes. Foreclosure. FOREClosureReview.com.
Independent foreclosure review.com. REVIEW.com.
Yes.
Okay. We got it. Just we put it in the chat room. What else now?
Okay. And there's another address, www.occ.trb.
Oh,
like treasure, but only is TREAS.
Okay, got it.
.gov.
.gov. Got it. All right.
So you can visit either of those three websites. It will give you the categories, and it'll tell you if you know which situation you fell in, as far as the foreclosure, if you didn't get foreclosed on, if you went through the process or whatever, between 2009 and 2010, you have some money coming. You might not even know it. So.
All right. Well, okay. Well,
I went out of town and came back, and I had a postcard saying you are eligible to receive a payment as a result of an agreement between Citibank and federal banking regulators, the Office of the Comptroller of the Currency and the Federal Reserve Board, announced in January. This payment is related to an enforcement action regarding deficiencies in the mortgage servicing and foreclosure process of Citibank. Payment will be made by the paying agent, Russ Consulting Incorporation. You will receive a check or additional information about your payment from Russ Consulting within approximately 4 to 8 weeks. Please watch your mail. So what happened was when you go on the website, it'll name all the different banks. It's not only just Citibank, but they name all the big dogs. Okay. And it will tell you, you know, the information that you need.
Okay. Well, now, in your opinion, do you think this is just an oversight, or do you think these people are criminals?
Okay, thank you. Okay, that's what I'm sorry. Could you repeat that, please?
Do you think these people are, was this just a slight oversight that they had to do all of this, or do you think they were criminals in the beginning?
I would definitely say criminals. I would definitely say criminals, because when I sent my letter to the president demanding my original documentation, like the sister said, they're sending you back a copy of your contract. They're sending you back a copy of your contract, and I'm like, I asked for the original. And
okay.
What about the 50-something questions that I asked them to provide the information, they checked off the boxes. This is not applicable to this. This is not applicable to that. Then I sent the letter to the president, and we did a jury trial. It was about 10 people on the list. List the CEO. All the other people, I don't even know who all these other people was that was on the list. But
okay.
I figured that I was demanding a jury trial. The next thing I know, I'm calling. I was in the process of doing a modification or something.
Modification.
All these documents,
you
already
said. Breaking up. Now, you're breaking up now. I can hardly hear you.
I was sending them all the information that they was requesting. So that loan modification thing, to me, is like a setup to make people lose their homes. Because in your process of going through a loan modification, they're just buying time to do whatever they got to do.
Uh-huh.
So, you know, it was amazing. I was like, I still can't believe that I don't have a mortgage payment.
Well, this is what I'm trying to get everybody to understand. Don't once you learn the rules of the game, it's just a game. They be doing their thing. It's designed for them. Sister, I'm going on to the next caller, but I certainly appreciate you calling in and giving us this.
They have missed their checks, that they could get on that website and call that phone number and see if they got some money that they have not received as a result of
Okay. Even
their house was foreclosed, short sales, anything that's pertaining to them trying to take your house. It's listed
okay.
right there. Peace and love.
Peace and love, sister. Okay. Mo, let's go down here now to 925. Come on in.
Hello.
Erico. Hey.
Hello, Brother Tahaka.
What's up? Let me
this
have it.
This is Stephanie
calling from the California Republic.
All right, Steph, what you got?
Hey, how are you?
I'm just fine. What's on your
mind? Good. So I was listening to your radio station. I got a check that the sister was talking about before. I have an investment property in Las Vegas, and I did try to short sell it, and they didn't really want to help me, so I got fed up and sent the keys back to the president, you know, certified mail before I learned about the affidavits. So I got a check for $3,000 last week, and people who were struggling with their modification homes, they never filled out the card, but they got some checks. They got a check too, so that was good news. My coworkers. So I wanted to tell you because I wrote these credit card companies and the bank a letter to stop calling me. Now they sold my number to this other survey company.
They That's wanted, good.
Yeah, so they call me. It's a robocall. So right now I have like 15 calls back to back.
Oh, Lord. Let me see. For 15 times $4,000 a call, have you?
I thought it was $1,500 per call, but man.
No, $4,000 a call. You'll be calling me all the time, Stephanie. What did you? I forgot what I told you.
Okay, so, I was really studying that about the Telephone Consumer Protection Act, okay? And I put my number on the new do not call list in 2007.
No. That's good. But all you got to do is send them a letter, say don't call this number right here, and just make a copy of the letter. And then if they keep doing it, every time they call, just make a notation of when they call your phone company, tell them to send you a printout of all the calls made in and out your house. That's put it to them. That's $4,000 a call.
Okay.
Don't be messing this thing up.
I'm not messing anything up. I took a picture of all the phone calls with my camera, so I know I have it saved already. So yeah.
All right. Okay.
So
all
thank
right.
you for your help. I love your show, and I'll talk to you later. Peace
okay.
And love.
So,
all right. Bye bye.
Bye bye. Okay. Area code 704. Come on
in. What's the name of the book?
What's the name of the book? What book? Hell book. go to hoggerarchives.org. www.
Hold up, brother.
Because
man,
what we do is, all right, see, if I gave you a book, and you just had the book, and then after you get to the book, then you're faced with going and doing something about it. And, you know, so all too often we get thrown off. So to keep that from happening, we give you an entire archive with total artillery. And then when you get ready to fire a shot, you got some shooters with you. So
you got some bullets.
all of us going to get them. We're going to help you get them together. So you go there and get that. Once you get the bombs, then call me. Then we're going to walk through this thing step by step until you do it. Get it right.
Okay, so the archives, could you actually spell the web address out that I need to go to?
That's www.taharka, TARAHAKA, archives, ARCHIVES.org. TaharkaArchives.org.
All right. Brother Man, let me ask you this then. Is it necessary for you to actually, because I've heard a lot of more say that you had to open your DTC, which is actually your direct treasury account associated with your straw man. Is it necessary for you to do an accepted for value on your birth certificate that was created by the government due to the bankruptcy?
Well, there's so many different ways that you can go at that. You could cancel all those contracts and be free, or you can sue about the contract and get paid, or you can use that contract and take possession of the contract. You can set up your will. You can set up your common law trust. You can start discharging debt on the private side. There's so many different things that you can that you can do with it. But you have to decide which way, which one of these stick you want to hit the giant in the head with.
All right, David.
It's under you. That's a question that I can't come out and say, oh, yeah, well, you just got to do it like this. No, because there's too many ways, you know, because it's too many criminals. All these criminals got these criminal activities. You can go at each, any kind of way you decide to go at it, you can follow through. We got it step by step until you succeed at every way you want to go. It's totally up to you. But you have to access the ammunition. Once you access the ammunition, then we're ready to drop the bombs. It's as simple as that. And you ain't in it by yourself. We helping you. We walking right along with you until it get done.
All right, Islamo. Peace and blessings.
Islamo. Peace and blessings, my brother. Thank you all for calling me. Okay, now, ladies and gentlemen, now what we finna do now is we finna go, since we know these criminals and we know this is a criminal activity, let's go and see if there's anybody else mad about this kind of stuff. If is it somebody else that don't like what's going on with this situation? So what we're going to do now is we're going to go in straight in Washington, D.C. on the floor, okay, and see what's going on. Wait a minute. Hold on a minute. Okay, here we go, right here. Y'all hold on a minute.
Madam President, the American people are angry. They are angry because they are living through the worst recession since the Great Depression. Unemployment is not 8.2%. Real unemployment is closer to 15%. Young people who are graduating high school and they're graduating college, they're going out into the world. They want to become independent. They want to create jobs. There are no jobs. There are workers out there, and I'm sure you know them, Madam President, 50, 55 years old, who intended to work out the remainder of their work lives. Suddenly they got a pink slip. Their self-esteem is destroyed. They're never going to have another job again, and now they're worried about their retirement security. And what the American people are angry about is they understand that they did not cause this recession. Teachers did not cause this recession. Firefighters and police officers who are being attacked daily by governors all over this country did not cause this recession. Construction workers did not cause this recession. This recession was caused by the greed, the recklessness, and the illegal behavior of the people on Wall Street. And what these people on Wall Street did is spend billions of dollars, trying to deregulate Wall Street. And they got their way. $5 billion in 10 years is what they spent. And then they were able to merge investment banks with commercial banks, with insurance companies. They got everything they wanted. They said, get the government off the backs of Wall Street. They got it. And the end result was that they plunged this country into the worst recession since the Great Depression. Now, Madam President, 4 years after the financial crisis caused by J.P. Morgan Chase, Bank of America, Goldman Sachs, and the other huge financial institutions, one might have thought that perhaps they learned something, that maybe the lesson of the great financial crisis was you cannot continue to maintain the largest gambling casino in the history of the world. But apparently they have not learned that a lesson. They are back at it again. And we have recently seen the $2 or $3 billion gambling losses at JP Morgan Chase. What we need from Wall Street, if we're going to put people back to work, is investments in the productive economy. Small and medium-sized businesses all over this country need affordable loans, and that's what financial institutions should be doing. They should be helping us create jobs, expand businesses, not continuing to engage in their wild and exotic gambling schemes. Now, Madam President, when we talk about why the American people are angry, they are angry because they understand that Wall Street received the largest taxpayer bailout in the history of the world. But it was not just the $700 billion that Congress approved through the TARP program. As a result of an independent audit that some of us helped to bring about in the Dodd-Frank bill, we learned, Madam President, that the Federal Reserve provided a jaw-dropping $16 trillion in virtually zero interest loans to every major financial institution in this country, to central banks all over the world, to large corporations in America, and in fact, to even wealthy individuals. And what the American people are saying is if the Fed could provide $16 trillion to large financial institutions, why cannot they begin to move to protect homeowners, unemployed workers, and the middle class of this country? Madam President, the American people are looking around them. And they are angry not just because unemployment is high. They're not angry. They're angry not just because millions of people have lost their homes and their life savings. They are angry because they understand that the middle class of this country is collapsing, poverty is increasing, while at the same time the people on top are doing phenomenally well. They, the taxpayers of this country, bail out Wall Street, and Wall Street recovers, Wall Street does well, but now we have kids in this country graduating college, deeply in debt, can't find a job. We have older workers losing their jobs, and people are saying, what is going on in America? The American people, ultimately, I believe, are angry because they are looking at this great country, a country which many of our veterans fought and died for. And what they are seeing is that this nation is losing its middle class, is losing its democratic values, and in fact is moving toward an oligarchic form of government where a handful of billionaires control the economic and political life of this nation. Madam President, in the United States today, we have the most unequal distribution of wealth and income since the 1920s. Now, you're not going to see what I'm talking about now. You're not going to see it on Fox. You're not going to see it on NBC or CBS. But it's important that we discuss this issue because it is one of the most important issues facing America. Madam President, today, the wealthiest 400 individuals in America own more wealth than the bottom half of America, 150 million people. 400 and 150 million. Today, and this is really quite amazing, the six heirs to the Walmart fortune, the Walmart company, of course, started by Sam Walton, his children, one family, now own more wealth than do the bottom 30% of the American people. One family owns more wealth than the bottom 30%, 90 million Americans. Today, the top 1% own 40% of all of the wealth in America. Top 1% own 40% of all the wealth in America. Madam President, what do we think the bottom 60% of the American people own? I ask this question a lot around Vermont. I have a lot of meetings. So what top 1% owns 40%? Okay. People say, yeah, we understand. That's not good. We understand that. What are the bottom 60%? People say, well, Maybe they own 15%. Maybe they own 20%. Well, the answer is they own less than 2%. Less than 2%. So you got the bottom 60% of the American people owning less than 2% of the wealth. Top 1% own 40% of the wealth. And here's another astounding fact. And again, I know we don't see this too much in the media. Many of my colleagues don't talk about it too often. But incredibly, the bottom 40% of the American people own 0.3% of the wealth of this country. And I know we have some of my colleagues coming up here and say, look, not everybody in America is paying taxes. You've got millions of people who are not paying any taxes. No kidding. They don't have any money because all of the money is on the top. Madam President, according to a new study from the Federal Reserve, median net worth for middle-class families dropped by nearly 40% from 2007 to 2010, primarily because of the plummeting value of homes. That is the equivalent of wiping out 18 years of savings for the average middle-class family. Now, I've talked a moment about distribution of wealth. That's what you accumulate in your lifetime. Let me say a word about income, which is what we earn in a year. The last study that was done on income distribution was done recently, and this is what it told us, and this is really literally quite hard to believe. The last study on income distribution showed us that between the years 2009 and 2010, 93% of all new income created in the previous year went to the top 1%. 93% of all of the new income created between 2009, 2010, last information we had, went to the top 1%, while the bottom 99% had the privilege of enjoying the remaining 7%. In other words, the wealthiest people in this country are becoming phenomenally wealthier, middle class is disappearing, and poverty is increasing. Now, when we talk about an oligarchic form of government, what we're talking about is not just a handful of families owning entire nations. We're also talking about the politics of the nation. And as a result of this disastrous Citizens United decision, which is now 2 years of age, the worst decision, one of the worst decisions ever brought about by the Supreme Court of this country, a decision that they just reaffirmed a few days ago with regard to Montana, what the Supreme Court has done is said to the wealthiest people in this country, okay, you own almost all the wealth of this nation, that's great. Now we're going to give you an opportunity to own the political life of this nation. And if you're getting bored by just owning coal companies and casinos and manufacturing plants, you now have the opportunity to own the United States government. So we have people like the Koch brothers and Sheldon Adelson. Koch brothers worth $50 billion. That's what they're worth. So if you're worth $50 billion, they have said they're prepared to put $400 million into this campaign to defeat Obama, to defeat candidates who are representing working families. Sheldon Adelson said he's only worth $20 billion. He's kind of a pauper. But he's willing to spend what it takes to buy the government. And if you look at it, it ain't a bad deal. If you're worth $50 billion and you spend $1 billion or $2 billion, you can buy the United States government. That's a pretty good investment. And that's what they are about to do. So on one hand, we have a grossly unequal distribution of wealth and income. These guys control the economy. You have the six largest financial institutions in this country that have assets equivalent to two-thirds of the GDP of America, over $9 trillion. These six financial institutions write half the mortgages, two-thirds of the credit cards in America, huge impact on the economy. That's not enough for these guys. Top 1% owns 40% of the wealth. not enough for these guys. Now they have the opportunity to buy the United States government. So that's where we are. Now, in my view, working families all over this country are saying enough is enough. They want this Congress to start standing for them and not just the millionaires and the billionaires who are spending unbelievable sums of money in this campaign. So it seems to me, Mr. President, that what we have got to do is start listening to the needs of working families, the vast majority of our people, and not just the people who make campaign contributions. Now, I know that's a very radical idea. I do know that. But, you know, it might be a good idea to try a little bit to reaffirm the faith of the American people in their democratic form of government. Let them know just a little bit that maybe we are hearing their pain, their unemployment, their debt, the fact they're losing their houses, the fact that they don't have any health care, the fact they can't afford to send their kids to college. Maybe, just maybe, we might want to listen to them before we go running out to another fundraising event with millionaires and billionaires. I do know, Mr. President, that is a radical idea. Let's talk about what we can actually do for the American people. In the midst of this terrible recession, where real unemployment is closer to 15%, if you include those folks who have given up looking for work and those people who are working part-time when they want to work full-time, we know that the fastest way to create decent-paying jobs is to rebuild our crumbling infrastructure. Now, I don't know about Minnesota, Mr. President, but I do know in Vermont, many of our bridges are in desperate need of repair. Our roads are in need of repair. Our rail system is falling further and further behind Europe and China. We got water systems that desperately need repair, wastewater plants. We have schools that need repair. We can put millions of people back to work, making our country more competitive, more efficient by addressing our infrastructure crisis. Let's do it. It is beyond my comprehension that we can't even get a modest transportation bill. I know that Chairwoman Boxer and Senator Inhofe are working on a modest transportation bill. We can't even get that through the House. In fact, we've got to do a lot more than that, but at least they're making the effort. Mr. President, at a time when we spend some $300 billion a year importing oil from Saudi Arabia and other foreign countries, at a time when this planet is struggling with global warming and all of the extreme weather disturbances that we see and the billions of dollars that we are spending in response to these extreme weather disturbances, we need to move toward energy independence. We need to reverse greenhouse gas emissions. In other words, we need to transform our energy system away from fossil fuel into energy efficiency and into sustainable energies like wind, solar, geothermal, and biomass. And when we do that, we also create a substantial number of decent-paying jobs. And by the way, in the midst of a very competitive global economy, what we should not be doing is laying off teachers and childcare workers. We should be investing in education, not laying off those people who are educating our kids. Mr. President, I know that there is a lot of discussion on the floor with regard to the national debt, almost $16 trillion, the deficit, over $1 trillion. That is a serious issue, and we've got to deal with it. But my view is a little bit different than many of my colleagues in terms of how we deal with it. Mr. President, I think most Americans understand the causation of the deficit crisis. And that is, President Bush went to war in Iraq, and he went to war in Afghanistan, and you know, he just forgot something. We all have memory lapses, don't we? Go shopping and we forget to buy the milk or the bread. He had a memory lapse. He forgot to pay for them. A couple of $1 trillion, and he forgot to pay for them. And all of our deficit hawks out here, all of those folks say, gotta cut food stamps, you gotta cut education, you gotta cut health care. Oh, two wars, two, three, $4 trillion. Hey, no problem. No problem at all. And For the first time, as I understand it, in the history of this country, we went to war, which is an expensive proposition, and at the same time, not only did we not raise the money to pay for the war, we went the other way. We decided to give huge tax breaks, including to the wealthiest people in this country. You spend trillions going to war, you give tax breaks to the wealthiest people in this country, well, that begins to add up. That's called creating a deficit. And then on top of that, because of the greed and the recklessness and illegal behavior on Wall Street, which drove us into this recession, when you're in a recession and people are unemployed and small businesses go under, less revenue is coming into the federal treasury. If you spend it a whole lot, less revenue is coming in, you have a deficit crisis. Now, some of my Republican friends, and some Democrats, I should say, they say, well, maybe we should have paid for the war. Yeah, you're right. Maybe we shouldn't have given those tax breaks to the rich. Yeah, maybe you're right. But be that as it may, we are where we are, and we need deficit reduction. And we know how to do it. We're going to cut Social Security. And my friends back home, when you hear folks talking about Social Security reform, hold on to your wallets, because they are talking about cuts in Social Security. Nothing more, nothing less. They're talking about something. I don't know about Minnesota, Mr. President. In Vermont, nobody has heard of the concept called chain CPI. Every place I go, I ask them. People don't know. Well, chain CPI, which is what they're trying to pass here, is the idea, and I know senior citizens back home are going to start laughing when I say this. It is the belief that COLAs for Social Security are too high. And seniors back home are scratching their heads like, wait, we just went through 2 years when my prescription drug costs went up, my health care costs went up, and I got zero in COLA, and there are people in Washington, Republicans, some Democrats, they think I got too much in COLA. What world are these people living in? And that's the reality. So some of the folks here want to pass something called a chain CPI, which, if it were imposed, and I will do everything I can to see that it does not get imposed, what it would mean is between the ages of 65 and 75, you would lose about $550 a year. And then when you are 85 and you're trying to get by or $13,000 or $14,000 a year, it would cost you about $1,000 a year. That's what some of our colleagues want to do. Virtually all the Republicans want to do it. Some Democrats want to do it as well. I'm going to do, as chairman of the Defending Social Security Caucus, everything that I can to prevent that. Now, they also want to cut Medicare, and they want to cut Medicaid. Well, we got 50 million people without any health insurance at all. We got people paying huge deductibles, Medicaid covering nursing home care. They want to cut Medicare and Medicaid. They have the brilliant idea, some of them, that maybe we should raise the retirement age for Medicare from 65 to 67. Mr. President, tell me about somebody in Minnesota who's 66 and is diagnosed with cancer. And if we do what the Republicans want us to do in the House, which is to create a voucher plan for Medicare, we'd give that person a check for, I don't know, $7,000, I think, or $8,000, and we'd say, you can go out to the private insurance company, anyone you want. Here's your $7,000 or $8,000. You're suffering with cancer. Go get your insurance. And I guess that would last you maybe 1 day or 2 days in the hospital. That's what it would do. That's the Republican plan. So, Mr. President, I agree that deficit reduction is a real issue. And I think we have got to deal with it. But we are not, if I have anything to say about it, going to deal with it on the backs of the elderly, the children, the sick, the poor, and the hungry. The way you deal with deficit reduction in a responsible way, in a fair way, is you say to the billionaires in this country who are doing phenomenally well, you make the point that Warren Buffett made, that there's something a little bit absurd that millionaires and billionaires today, in the midst of the deficit crisis, are paying the lowest tax rates that they have paid in decades. So, yes, we're going to have to ask the wealthiest people in this country to start paying their fair share of taxes. I saw a piece in the paper the other day. It was quite incredible. The rich people apparently leave in America. They're giving up their citizenship. They're going abroad. These great lovers of America who made their money in this country, when you ask them to start paying their fair share of taxes, they're running abroad. We have 19-year-old kids in this country who died in Iraq and Afghanistan defending this country. They went abroad not to escape taxes. They're working-class kids who died in wars, and now the billionaires that want to run abroad in order to avoid paying their fair share of taxes. What patriotism? What love of country? So, Mr. President, yeah, we got to deal with deficit reduction. But you don't cut Social Security. You don't cut Medicare. You don't cut Medicaid. You don't cut education. You ask the wealthiest people, the millionaires and billionaires, to start paying their fair share of taxes. You end these outrageous corporate loopholes. Senator Conrad showed a picture of a building in the Cayman Islands where there are 18,000 corporations. They're there in the Cayman Islands using a postal address in order to avoid paying their taxes. We're losing about $100 billion a year. You got large corporations making billions, paying in some cases nothing in taxes. That's the way you go to deficit reduction, not on the backs of people who are already hurting. So, Mr. President, we are in a very difficult moment in American history. We're in the process of losing the great middle class. We're seeing more of our people being poor. We're seeing savage attacks being waged against the elderly in terms of cuts in Social Security and Medicare, attacks against those who get sick in terms of going after Medicaid and Medicare. And I think what the American people are saying is enough is enough. This country, this great country, belongs to all of us. It cannot continue to be controlled by a handful of billionaires who apparently want it all. You know, I cannot understand why people who have billions of dollars are compulsively driven for more and more and more. When is enough enough? How many children in this country have got to go hungry? How many people have got to die because they don't go to a doctor? Because you want to avoid paying your taxes. Well, that's not what America is about. That's not what people fought and died to create. So, Mr. President, with that, we've got a fight on our hands. The job of the United States Senate is to represent the middle class, working families of this country, all of the people, and not just the super rich. And I hope we can begin to do that. Thank you very much. With that, I yield the floor and note the absence of a quorum.
The desegregation decisions and other type of legislation and Supreme Court decisions depends upon changing the white man's mind. The Honorable Elijah Muhammad teaches us that our own mind has to be changed. We have to change our mind about ourselves.
In what way?
Well, so he teaches us the importance of moral reformation, a knowledge of self. And for instance, the average so-called Negro, he doesn't think that he can go into business and provide jobs for himself. And because of this, he thinks that he can only get a job from the white man, or he can only get clothes from the white man, or he can only get food from the white man. And we who follow the Honorable Elijah Muhammad are taught that the same thing that the white man has done for himself and his kind, if our people could be if we could be cured of our slave mentality that was indoctrinated into us during slavery, we would realize that just as the white man can do these things for himself and his kind, we can get together in unity and harmony and do the same thing for ourselves and our kind. The white man brainwashed the so-called Negro to the point of believing in white supremacy so much that today some Negroes think that they're not making progress or they don't have anything unless they're living in a white neighborhood, unless they have the white man's neighborhood, a seat in the white man's school, or a position on the white man's job, and they even have taken it so far they don't think they're successful in life unless they have a white woman as a wife.
Okay. Boom. Ladies and gentlemen, we're moving to the close of the broadcast, and I hope we have been able to provide you with some kind of aid. Keep in mind, for those of you who want to get a solution to your problem, go to www.tahakaarchive.org, or before you do, call me. Chicago at 904-303-9061 before 7 p.m. Eastern Standard Time, and we'll get with you and get to the solution on what your problem is. I hope that you all have enjoyed this enlightening information. We try to cover it from every conceivable angle. Now you know what they're doing. The straw man, these are what? Crab on nose. So, ladies and gentlemen, good night. Y'all have a nice night.
One cup of coffee, then I go. One cup of coffee, then I go.